Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's Arts Forum, and your chair for today. We welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Many thanks to the San Francisco Ballet, our sponsoring organization for today. I want to particularly thank Cecilia Beam, Adult Education Director for the Ballet, for her tireless efforts in facilitating today's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce San Francisco Ballet's 2012 visiting scholar, Beth Genet. For 7 years, the Ballet Center for Dance Education has invited an internationally known dance and music scholars to share their knowledge with patrons, staff, artists, and students of the ballet. The goal of the program is to inform and inspire all ballet lovers by giving them special insight into the creators of the ballets in our repertoire. And this year's scholar, Beth Genet, will give a presentation, which she's doing throughout the weekend, about Balanchine's Masterworks program, which is tonight, opening, celebrating San Francisco Ballet's 60 years of performing George Balanchine's ballets. It runs through April 18th. Dr. Genet, a professor of dance history and art history at University of Michigan, specializes in 20th century American and British ballet, as well as dance in the American film musical. She has a special interest in George Balanchine and his relationship to popular as well as classical dance, and was a principal researcher for the George Balanchine Foundation's project, Popular Balanchine, on Balanchine's work in Hollywood. She organized the International Symposium from the Mariinsky to Manhattan, George Balanchine and the Transformation of American Dance, as well as being one of five American scholars invited to present her research in Russia at the symposium, Balanchine, Past, Present, and Future, at the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. She's the author of numerous articles, as well as a book on the founder of the Royal Ballet, named Ninette de Voila. Her next book is a study in dance in the American musical film and the contributions of Balanchine, Fred Astaire, and Gene Kelly. And now, please welcome Dr. Genet.
Well, thank you very much. Can you hear me? Okay. I need to turn the computer. The computer should be on. Yeah. Okay. Let me first say how delighted I am to be here and how wonderful I think San Francisco Ballet is. You've got a wonderful company here. You're very lucky, I think. I've seen them over the years, and they are, as I say, a world-class company. So those of you who don't have tickets tonight, I think you should get them, or sometime over the weekend. Let me start by just saying that if you're seated in the back and you see there are some seats up front, it's a good idea to come up front because I'm going to be showing images on this screen. And if you can go over there, that will help you a lot in seeing what I'm talking about. Balanchine was a person who was all about the moving image, seeing the moving image, and hearing the music. I'll talk about this later. He used to say, see the music, hear the dance. So I want you to be able to see the music and hear the dance as much as you can. So as I say, and if you guys over there, if you want to get up in the middle or you want to kind of come closer and stand and look, that's fine too. Okay, I won't be offended if you get up. Okay, the title of my talk is Diamonds, the Many Facets of Balanchine's Style. But first let's start by talking a little bit about Balanchine himself, the man. George Balanchine, or as he was born, he was a Georgian, George Gyorgy Balanchivadze, has been compared to Shakespeare and Mozart in the scope, the depth, and the power of his work. He was born a subject of the Tsar in 1904 in Russia. He died in the United States as a citizen of the United States. He was trained at the Russian Imperial Ballet School, and he survived the Russian Revolution as a teenager, escaping the Soviet Union in 1924. At age 20, he became resident choreographer for Diaghilev's revolutionary company, the Ballet Russe, in Paris. And after Diaghilev's death in 1929, he came to the United States in 1933. He came at the beginning of the Great Depression, but despite this, he was able to establish the School of American Ballet and the company that the school serves, and that is the New York City Ballet. Through his school and his company, ballet put down roots in the United States, and his students and ex-dancers, like Lou Christensen, one of the great leaders of San Francisco Ballet, spread the Balanchine kind of message across the United States and Europe. Now most ballet companies have a work by Balanchine. But San Francisco Ballet, like Miami City Ballet, which is run by Edward Villela, and a company at the Kennedy Center run by Suzanne Farrell, are really the heirs of the Balanchine tradition in that they were established and run by people who worked directly with Balanchine. Balanchine's work, like a diamond, has many facets, each reflecting, as a diamond does, shifting light, and the various facets of Balanchine's personality, interests, and experiences are reflected in his dancers. But at the same time, it's always the same jewel. Tonight, San Francisco Ballet premieres a program of three Balanchine ballets: Scotch Symphony, which you see at the top, Four Temperaments below on my right, and then Divertimento number 15. Each ballet looks different. You could even see that in the pictures that I'm giving you, the still images that I'm giving you. Each ballet looks different in music, costume, mood, and movement style, but they all share qualities that are distinctly and recognizably Balanchine. What I hope to give you at the end of this talk is a way to recognize and understand some of those facets as reflected in the three ballets you are going to see tonight, but also be able to begin to understand what makes them distinctly Balanchine. So I can't talk about everything because there's too much, but I'm going to try to give you some ways of handling this material. So let's start with the basics. Balanchine grew up within a dance tradition and a vocabulary that started around 500 years ago, first in Italy and then in France. What we now call classical ballet, or sometimes just ballet, grew out of social dance in the courts of Italy and France, where dancing masters created positions of the body and ways of moving that were gradually developed into a vocabulary for theatrical dance. Because the system was codified in France, the name of those basic academic movements are in French, just like in music, it's Italian. They're in French, and many have entered the English language now, pirouette, pas de deux, other things. This tradition included a way of training the body for maximum flexibility, symmetry, and balance. And Balanchine on the screen, which you can see in front of you, is demonstrating one of the most basic movements of the feet, or in the and positions of the body. This is the thing that with which every dancer starts. How do you get your foot moving and eventually off the ground? Balanchine as a teacher would extend the vocabulary of this movement, but his roots remain solidly in the tradition he was taught as a child. As you know, probably, Balanchine was also a musician as well as a choreographer. He studied music along with ballet at the St. Petersburg Conservatory. He was an accomplished pianist. He could sight read and transcribe scores, and he composed himself both classical and popular songs. Everyone knows about his close relationship with Igor Stravinsky, but he had close relationships with other musicians as well, some of whom wrote works for him. One of them was Hindemith, who wrote the Four Temperaments for Balanchine, but there was also Maurice Ravel, Nicholas Nabokov, Vladimir Dukhelsky, Richard Rodgers, and George and Ira Gershwin. One of his closest composer friends was Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. Actually, though, Tchaikovsky died before Balanchine was born. But Balanchine was convinced that he communicated with Tchaikovsky in the spiritual world through his music. He really was. "I spoke to Tchaikovsky the other day," he would tell his dancers, "and he advised me on this ballet." Quote. True story. The basic time-honored traditions in dance is to teach dance by showing it, by demonstrating it. The teacher demonstrates and the students mirror their movements. Balanchine, as everyone knows, was an extraordinary demonstrator. But sometimes, to convey the quality of what he wanted, Balanchine would create a verbal metaphor to explain clearly the quality of a particular movement or to convey an idea to his dancers. As you all know, English was Balanchine's second language. First language was Russian. But he could be surprisingly eloquent in English. I'm going to use Balanchine's own metaphors throughout this talk to show you what was important to him. For him, and this is first and foremost, the music was the foundation of everything he choreographed. As he put it, "Music is the floor on which we dance." But "music is the floor on which we dance" tells you about the foundational role of music in Balanchine's choreography, but it doesn't tell you quite enough. The music doesn't just support and motivate Balanchine's dance. So Balanchine added another metaphor. He used to say, quote, "I want you to see the music and hear the dance," unquote. The musical style and structure of the work determines the style and structure of the dance. The dancers do not Mickey Mouse, that is the way they do in cartoons. They parallel the music. They interact with it so that the whole ballet becomes more than just the sum of its parts. The synergy of music and dance creates a new whole. This is the aspect of Balanchine that it is easy to feel, to sense, but unless you're both a musician and a dancer, a composer and a choreographer, as Balanchine was, it is difficult to demonstrate in the time that I have here. But here's how Igor Stravinsky described it. He said, "Balanchine's choreography reveals to me something about my own music that I didn't know was there." And I thought I'd give you a little demonstration with my hands. The radio audience can't see this, but, you know, you can think about the dance as one thing and the music as another. Usually when you see dance, the music accompanies the dance. It's right there. The dance is here and the music is here. With Balanchine, the music and the dance interact like this. And I'm closing, you know, like this is the church, this is the steeple. Is that what they call the thing? Okay. So that really there's another structure that's made. When a young choreographer, or sorry, a young dancer named Ruthanna Boris asked Balanchine what it took to be a good choreographer, he advised her, quote, "You have to be a very good dancer yourself. I didn't say famous. I said good. You have to know how dancers feel. You will never know unless you have done it. Then you have to know the music very, very well. Then you have to look everywhere. Look at everything all the time. Look at the grass and the concrete when it's broken. Look at children and little dogs and the ceiling and the roof. Your eye is a camera and your brain is a file cabinet." And that's the metaphor I want you to remember. Your eye is a camera and your brain is a file cabinet. Thus, for Balanchine, the academic ballet vocabulary was the foundation of his choreography, but he also built on it and extended the choreography from getting ideas from the world around him. Balanchine was exceptionally alert to the sights around him. He took in everything. We'll talk about some of the things he took in later, but you have to understand that everything he saw was put in the file cabinet to come out to be used later for choreography. Another young would-be choreographer named Anne Hutchinson asked Balanchine for advice too. And Balanchine's response to her was also important. He said, "A choreographer can do no better than to look at the folk dance of different countries. They have done everything," unquote. From the beginning of his life, Balanchine was surrounded by folk music, and not just any folk music. His father, Meliton Balanchivadze, was from Georgia, not our Georgia, but the Georgia across the sea. So little Gyorgy grew up loving and understanding the folk music of his father's native land. One of his favorite performing ensembles was the Georgian State Ballet. Here he portrays himself as a Georgian in a Georgian soldier's uniform. You can see the little, it's like the row of bullets. You can keep the bullets in there and then the sword at the side. And you can see this is Balanchine's own caricature. He drew himself as a Georgian dancer. You'll notice that he's dancing on his toes in a distinctly Georgian way. The Georgians do not dance on the tips of their toes. They dance on the knuckles of their toes. So, yikes. But Balanchine didn't just love Georgian folk dance. He loved and respected all folk music, and he loved all dance from every country. And you can see that in his ballets. This brings us to our first ballet, Scotch Symphony. In Scotch Symphony tonight, you'll see Balanchine's love of Scottish folk dance and also his love of another form, the military parade. Scotch Symphony was born after Balanchine saw what's called the Edinburgh Tattoo. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this, but it is, one of you has. This is a ceremonial parade of the Scottish regiments, which complete with bagpipers and flags. It's held every year in Edinburgh in the shadow of Edinburgh Castle, which dominates the city skyline. You can see that here on the slide. Balanchine's then wife, Maria Tallchief, who became the principal dancer of Scotch Symphony, and we'll see her dance in a minute, went with him to the tattoo, and she has described her husband's thrilled response. She said he was just over the moon about it. Everything about it thrilled him. Balanchine pulled that experience out of his file cabinet when he got back to New York. He chose Mendelssohn's Scotch Symphony as a score, and Mendelssohn's music was also written in a response to a trip that the composer took to Scotland. And in Scotch Symphony, you'll see a lot of kilts, a lot of motifs. Wait a minute, hold on. You'll see a lot of kilts. You'll see a lot of motifs from Scottish dancing. You'll see a lot of distinctive port de bras. That's Scottish port de bras, meaning carriage of the arms. So you'll see this kind of thing that you see in Highland dancing with the arm, one arm akimbo on the waist, and another one lifted up. You'll also see this position with both arms lifted up. And you'll also see the quick, precise, really twinkling footwork. That is one of the joys of Highland dancing. The dancers skim over the floor. They're almost like hovercraft. You know what I'm talking about? Like they... So I'm going to say, watch especially in the first movement. There's a soloist. There's a solo for a female dancer, and you're going to see that kind of dancing, that really quick. If you've ever seen the quick step in ballroom dancing, do you know what I'm talking about? That you get the feeling they're moving so fast, you kind of barely see their feet. Scotch Symphony also reflects another aspect of Balanchine's style. That is his love of dance history, his veneration for the ballet masters that came before him. In 1832, Philippe Taglioni created the ballet La Sylphide, and you see an image, two images from La Sylphide on the screen. La Sylphide just simply means the sylph. It's a landmark ballet of French Romanticism and one of the first ballets to incorporate point work, what we call point work, which is actually historically a relatively recent phenomenon in ballet. It really starts going around 1832, but people don't really dance sustained on point. They just rise to the tips of their toes. But they don't do sustained point work really until the 1880s and 90s. La Sylphide is about a magical sprite who lures a young Scotsman named James to abandon his home, his family, and his mortal fiancée to live and love this beautiful, delightful woodland sprite. But it is to no avail. Mortals and spirits can never be together. The sylph dies at the end, and James does too. On the screen left is the opening scene of the ballet with Taglioni as the sylph kneeling at the Scotsman's feet. By the way, Queen Victoria adored this ballet. She copied out that scene in her drawing books. You can look them up, and there's that scene. Very excited about the sylph and La Sylphide. The sylph kneels next to the sleeping Scotsman. On the right is one of the many lithographs of Marie Taglioni, who first danced the sylph. And there she is. She's got etched points. The lithographer sharpened her toes. I mean, they really, really weren't that. You actually see that in early photographs of Pavlova, the dancer Anna Pavlova. The retoucher comes in and makes the points look really, really tiny. They really weren't that. That way, it's artistic license. It's poetic license. This theme, though, unattainable ideal in the form of a woman that a man briefly possesses but always loses, is a major theme of Balanchine's works, from his earliest ballets to his very latest. And it's a perfect subject for dance. He is always chasing. He is always chasing. She's always pulling away. She's always running away. Don't touch, Balanchine used to say. Almost is more interesting. Almost. So, you know, have it for a minute, and then boom, it's taken away from me. Balanchine would tell his dancers, quote, "Each man going through the world with his destiny on his back meets a woman he cares about, but his destiny has other plans." Balanchine told his biographer that this, he uses this term that's often used to describe what he's about. He said, "For me, ballet is a woman." And it is. He does wonderful things for male dancers, but it's his development of the women, his development of their technique, their way of moving, his really adulation, a very romantic adoration, a very 19th century adoration of women, that run a through line throughout his ballets. So in Scotch Symphony, the hero has to chase the ballerina through a maze formed by the bodies of the male corps de ballet, who loft the ballerina towards him. But as soon as they have touched her, they rush in to form a barrier between the hero and his love. And this is really Balanchine's tribute to La Sylphide. And La Sylphide, one of the specialties was making ballerinas fly through the air, and they would often hang them on wires. And they would—you'd see these sylphs. If you've ever seen a reconstruction of the original La Sylphide, you'll see these poor little ballerinas floating on wires in the back. You know what I mean? Taking poses and stuff. So that's a little bit. This is a Balanchine reference to that. So let's take a look. Oh, one more thing. But Scotch Symphony, unlike La Sylphide, doesn't tell a detailed story with a beginning, middle, and the end. While there are movement and costume references to the sylph and James, Balanchine, in a manner unique to him, distilled the narrative by streamlining his dancers' movements into a flow of images that convey the essence of the ballet. It's a kind of modern ballet poem to La Sylphide, suggesting rather than detailing the relationship between man and sylph, and the man and the sylph and his community. within the Scottish setting. This is true of many Balanchine ballets. You'll find that there is actually a kind of a hidden narrative in the relationships between the dancers, but it's not something that you don't need to know about La Sylphide to love this ballet. You know, you don't need to have found out about this. So let's take a look at Maria Talchief, who was the first self dancing the Andante movement of Scotch Symphony, just a part of it. We only have time for a part of it. But you'll see this kind of, you know, approach avoidance idea. You know, he almost has her, then he doesn't have her, then he doesn't have her. So let's hope this film works. There we go. So you see the hero, Andrei Aglevsky here, is standing, dreaming by himself, and suddenly the sylph wakes him up. And he sees her and he's enthralled. So this whole next section is going to be about him briefly dancing with her, but then she's going to run away. He has her for a moment. And there's the arms akimbo, which are very Scottish. And then he kisses her hand, but boy, she pulls away. Then he tries again. Has her briefly, but then he runs for her. She's running away. Catches her one more time. But now, nope, she's pulling away. She's trying to go away, and he's trying to hold on to her. And then he has to let go, and here come this group of Highlanders who prevent her from being with him. So he sees her through a barrier. You see that a lot in Balanchine ballets. Some kind of a barrier is formed by people, and the hero and the heroine have to work through the barrier, try to get through the barrier of these people. And here the sylph is lost in the air. He catches her briefly, but then she's pulling away again. Then she's hidden in this kind of protective armor of the Highlanders. Okay. So you'll see more tonight. Hope that whets your appetite. Scotch Symphony is not the only place that Balanchine uses motifs or concepts from the step dancing of Scotland and the British Isles. Along with the formation marching of parades, one of the most stunning spectacles he ever created toward the end of his life was a piece called Union Jack, a ballet that had for a first act a gathering together of various kilt-clad ballet dancers who marched in ever more fascinating formations on the stage with the most extraordinary variety and virtuosity. It was Balanchine's, again, take on the Edinburgh tattoo and Scottish folk dance. The last movement of Union Jack, however, went south to England, where we saw Balanchine's variations on the sailor's hornpipe and other British step dances. And you can look for other folk dance motifs in just about every Balanchine ballet. In Mr. B's work, the characteristic from-the-heart Russian port-a-bras, you often see this. this kind of thing from Russian dancing. Courtly French social dance forms, especially in this wonderful ballet Tombeau de Couperin. Hungarian gypsy dances that you see in Brahms Schoenberg Quartet, in Symphony in C. In the first movement, there's a little reel in which dancers go under bridges made by other dancers, clearly a reference to folk dance. So let's go on to the next section. Balanchine may have grown up in the imperial ballet tradition, but he came of age in the modern world. He came of age in the jazz age, in the Roaring Twenties. At age 20 in 1924, he was living in Paris and London and working for the Diaghilev Ballet Russe, which was a company at the forefront, I'm sure you've heard of this, of avant-garde ballet. Artists like Matisse, de Chirico, and Rouault created sets and costumes for Balanchine ballets. Stravinsky and Prokofiev created the music for his ballets. And he took in the exciting artistic life around him, including the jazz age sensation Josephine Baker, with whom he became good friends and may have had an affair. On the screen from left to right, you see Le Bal, which is a ballet he created in the 20s with costumes by de Chirico. Right next to that, you see the costume sketch that de Chirico made for that particular costume. And then at the far end, Josephine Baker doing her signature dance, the Charleston, which Balanchine adored. Balanchine choreographed for Josephine Baker in Paris, we know. I've argued in an article that Josephine Baker was his first American muse. He loved the way she moved, especially the use of her hips and her long, beautiful legs and her extreme musicality. He talked about that until the day he died when he was choreographing one of his last ballets, Mozartiana. He told his dancers, legs like Josephine. She had the most beautiful legs. You should think about those legs. After Diaghilev's death in 1929 and out of a job, Balanchine eventually made his home in America, where in addition to ballet, he also worked on Broadway with the Gershwin brothers and Rodgers and Hart. In the developing era of the golden age of musical comedy music, to which he was a major contributor, beginning in 1933, he really made New York permanently and definitively his home. And he began to develop this new style of ballet and jazz movement to create a form of jazz ballet that you see on Broadway. We're going to be talking about that in a talk I'm giving on Your Toes next week. He embraced the speed, the vitality, and the dynamism of American life and the streamlined look of this new city. The four temperaments of the title of the ballet that we're going to talk about next, the title ostensibly refers to the ancient idea that humans are made up of four different humors or temperaments. We all possess these four humors, but in different degrees, and it's from the dominance of one of the humors that the four physical and psychological types come from as codified in the Middle Ages, melancholic, depressed, I would say sanguinic, full of life, full of lively, phlegmatic, laid back, kind of uninterested, and choleric, full of powerful, aggressive energy. Hindemith used that for his music of the four temperaments, but neither really the music or the ballet make literal interpretations of the idea. So I'm just going to tell you about that, and I'm going to talk about other things and connections with the four temperaments. In a trip by streamliner across the United States to Hollywood, Balanchine savored the vastness of his new land. In The Four Temperaments, the second of the ballets tonight, he presented a style that not only fit with the modern music of Paul Hindemith, from whom he commissioned the score, but the distinctive quality of modern American life, the speed and dynamism, the straight lines, vectors, angles of the modern world that's exemplified in the streamliner above can be seen in The Four Temperaments. And it's the age of the streamliner when Balanchine comes in. It's the age of Art Deco. And so that's why I put the streamliner up above. This is the final section of Four Temperaments. As a man of the jazz age, Balanchine was fascinated by the jazz dance of his youth, and one of the key characteristics of his style is the inspiration that he draws from the free use of the hips and torso that jazz dancers exhibit, as well as their interest in asymmetry, the off-balance quality that jazz dancers like Josephine Baker, the Nicholas brothers with whom Balanchine worked, and Balanchine's great idol, Fred Astaire, present. Four Temperaments is imbued with his love of these dancers. And here you see Balanchine demonstrating a hip-jutting position, and again demonstrating with Suzanne Farrell and Arthur Mitchell. This is not actually from Four Temperaments, but he's teaching them Slaughter on 10th Avenue, which we'll be talking about next week. This is the ballet in On Your Toes. The use of the hips, especially the initiation of movement with the hips, that is starting a movement from here, from the hips, is a characteristic that runs across Balanchine ballets of all kinds and types, from the classical Apollo, here's 1928, Apollo you see, in 1928, to Balanchine's celebration of the Gershwins in his ballet, Who Cares, in 1970. It's even in Scotch Symphony and Divertimento No. 15. Watch closely for it. You'll find it in the most unexpected places. Another characteristic of jazz dance is the replacement of the soft, rounded curves of 19th century ballet with angles. In his works to Hindemith and Stravinsky, Balanchine loves the patterns made by angles of the wrist, knee, and foot. Instead of the extension of the arm in an unbroken line, he allows his dancers to cock their wrists. You see that on the screen. He will often use a flexed foot instead of a pointed one, as you'll see in the opening moments of Four Temperaments. And as in the slide above, Balanchine loves to make angular and dynamic patterns by combining bodies in new and fascinating ways. And I love that pose that you see on the screen. Another characteristic that comes from jazz dancers is the emphasis on dancing off balance as opposed to the strictly stable and symmetrical movement of classical ballet. Balanchine adored off balance dancing, and again, it is something you can see in all of his ballets and all of the ballets tonight. Here's an example on the screen from Concerto Barocco set to Bach. You can see the ballerina is way off balance. It's precarious looking, sorry. Okay. She really looks as if she's going to fall over, but the principle of counterbalance, which is what you see in swing dancing, and you see above two swing dancers pulling at each other, will keep them together. You see a lot of counterbalancing in Balanchine's partnering. Okay. So this kind of thing, for example. Here's an example from Four Temperaments that illustrates Balanchine's love of off-balance dancing. You can see these dancers leaning way back here. But it's also an illustration of one of Balanchine's favorite instructions. Often he would say to dancers, "You are being too polite, too dainty. I want more," capital more. "Higher extensions, cover more space, more energy, more dynamism. Don't be afraid." Another favorite maxim of Balanchine's was, "What are you waiting for? There is only now. Dance now." It's an attitude that in part comes from Balanchine's own bitter experience of illness brought on by the trials of the Russian Revolution and its aftermath. Balanchine had only one lung, and when he first came out of Russia, he was expected not to live long. He was sent to a sanatorium in Switzerland. He recovered, but he was always shadowed by potential illness. As Balanchine himself said, quote, "You know, I am really dead man. I was supposed to die, and I didn't. And so now everything I do is second chance. That is why I enjoy every day. I don't look back. I don't look forward. Only now." In asking for these qualities more and now, Balanchine was reflecting the dynamism of his new land and modern life. He also developed a look for the American woman that he saw all around him. Examples of the American women are all around him in the 1930s. Remember, 1920, women get the vote. 1930, think of those 30s romantic comedies, and you'll know what I'm talking about, the spunky woman. Balanchine loved powerful women. He used to go home from rehearsals to watch Wonder Woman in the 1970s. Here she is, Linda Carter, and he actually had a cardboard cutout of Linda Carter on his the back of his door in his bedroom. But the power of Balanchine's dancers was not like Linda Carter's, an illusion. Yeah, these women could leap tall buildings in a single bound with no help from special effects or from a man. Here's an example. It's what we call an Italian pas-de-chaux in the air by one of Balanchine's dancers. We'll see all that in The New Woman of the Four Temperaments. In creating this new woman, and I'll show you an excerpt in just a minute, Balanchine creates a new kind of ballerina, very different from the fragile and ethereal sylph. Arlene Croce once called the Balanchine ballerina, quote, the freest woman alive, unquote. And in Four Temperaments, you can see that. Here is Balanchine's American ballerina as presented in all her splendor. She soars on point with unprecedented speed and dynamism. She covers spaces like never before. She's streamlined and openly powerful. You can certainly see this in this next excerpt that I'm going to show you of Meryl Ashley in The Four Temperaments. But you can see it, the other characteristics I've talked about as well. The emphasis on streamlining, not ornamental curves, but lines and angles of all kinds, as well as off-balance movement and space-covering dancing. So let's take a look at that now. Watch her lean back. Whoa. Here's off-balance. And now you can see the angles, the use of the angles, the use of the hips, initiating movement with the hips. Okay. Here's the same dancer in another ballet you're going to see tonight, Divertimento number 15. This is a series of dances to Mozart's Divertimento number 15, a series of beautiful pieces that Mozart put together. It gives Balanchine an excuse to present a series of beautiful dances to the music of Mozart, who was one of his favorite composers. Here Balanchine's severe angles and vector shapes are subdued somewhat, and the partnering is also more courtly and subdued, yet those distinctive characteristics show through. Notice the dynamism of the arabesque that you're seeing on screen now, how the ballerina seems to literally be flying, her arms and legs stretched to the maximum. She seems to be barely touching the earth. Here the ballerina leans back on her partner. He doesn't hold her up by gripping her tightly. She's just balanced on him. Can you see that? She's slightly off balance, but she's off balance nonetheless. Look for it in the andante movement of Divertimento number 15. Finally, I want to show you an example of Balanchine's love of making interesting and dynamic patterns by combining bodies in interesting ways. I love this formation you can see on the screen, and Balanchine repeats it in various ways in some of his ballets. If you've ever seen Monumentum pro Gesualdo, it's the same concept here of combining a number of dancers to create a really fascinating pattern. So in conclusion, what I'm going to do is show you a section from Divertimento number 15 where you can look for these patterns. Balanchine's fascinating arrangements of groups is something I haven't been able to touch much on. But what I want to, I really want to give you a taste of that facet of Balanchine's genius as seen in Divertimento number 15. Balanchine's ability to move people across and around the stage is phenomenal. He creates an effect in this piece, a little like a kaleidoscope, in which patterns morph from one to the other as you watch, but the seams don't show. They really don't. If you, you'll pay attention to the changes, but the flow, it looks as if it's happening naturally, like the blossoming of a flower or a kaleidoscope, the way a kaleidoscope works. It looks beautiful at every stage of the transformation. Balanchine gets this technique, I think, from folk dancing. In this section from Divertimento number 15, Balanchine has an odd number of dancers. I want you to notice that, or an odd number of males and females. He has three men and one, two, three, four, five women. Okay, so you don't have balanced partnering here. You don't have a balance of people. However, he moves them around so beautifully that you never think, oh, there's an odd woman out. You know, where is she? So let's take a look at that, and then we'll have questions. So watch how he moves the dancers around from front to back in different combinations. You'll notice there's never the same thing going on. Everybody's moving all the time. And he's forming different patterns. Here's a wonderful one. Again, it's like folk dance where you go under the bridge made by your you and your partner. And now she kind of threads her way through this tapestry. Now here come seamlessly your two men. And now you have another pattern. And now watch them unfold. And listen to his... Okay, so I hope you got something from that to walk away with. Thank you. Oh, you got a question.
Thank you. That was wonderful. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the Member-Led Arts Forum, and you're listening to Beth Janae, visiting scholar of San Francisco Ballet. We do have a couple of questions. Do I have any more questions? I must say, I got a real thrill when I saw the Maria Talchief, Andrea Glefsky. Yeah. I had the pleasure of seeing that in New York.
So, yeah. I wish I had.
The first question is, what are the challenges for a researcher of Balanchine's choreography and artistic direction?
Big ones, big challenges. One of the things about researching Balanchine I found is that, you know, ballet is really a visual art. And I have training in art history, but also in musicology. And one of the things that really, the clearest, most important thing that I do is to look and listen. And I combine those with observations of dancers that I talk to. Dancers really know, who've danced Balanchine's work, especially those dancers that Balanchine worked with and set pieces on, are this incredible font of information about how Balanchine wanted people to move, how he wanted them to look, the qualities that are in his ballets. But as I said before, ballet is something that's usually not taught verbally. You don't teach it with words. You teach it by showing. And so what I've done is to try to go around to all the dancers I can find who worked with Balanchine and actually talk to them and have them show me what it was that he wanted. What did he stress? What was he interested in? I think one of the problems with dance history sometimes, and also dance criticism, is that the people who write it, they really don't have words to describe what it is that's going on. So they get kind of deflected. You know what I mean? They talk all around what's going on. What's really going on is the music and the dance. And that's really what Balanchine was interested in. So if you approach it, let's say, the way a music historian or an art historian would style, then you can begin to think about not only what makes this look like Balanchine, right, but also how is it integrated with music to make this these structures that Balanchine talks about. So in many ways, you can begin if you look, and I've looked, one of the things I did, I spent a year, 2 years actually in New York doing research, and I spent all my time at New York City Ballet. But I also went back into the archives of this wonderful collection, the Dance Collection, which I totally recommend that you go to anybody who loves ballet. It's on the third floor of the Performing Arts Library at Lincoln Center, which is right next to the Metropolitan Opera House and across the plaza from New York City Ballet. Anyone can go there. And Jerome Robbins, with the royalties from Fiddle Around the Roof, how about this? He began this dance collection. You can not only see Balanchine, but you could see dances from all over the world. And you can take them to your little individual screen, and you can run them back and forth, and you can stop them and pause them. And I spent 2 years doing that, and I've never had so much fun in my life. Really, no kidding. Because if you love to watch, if you love to watch movement and hear music, there's no one better to watch than Balanchine. And the more you see, the more you watch, just like Balanchine says, the more you watch, the more you see. And then you begin to understand sometimes what the dancers have said to you in these metaphors that I'm talking about, or that Balanchine. And I studied very carefully. I took Balanchine's metaphors very seriously. Everything he said, I took very seriously. So so that was it. That's how I did it. Okay. Oh, boy. Best Balanchine biography. Well, they're different kinds, you know. My own feeling, to be really honest, is that the best Balanchine biography hasn't been written yet. And I think it's because the biographers that write about, they talk about what he, his life and the events of his life, but they don't actually analyze the ballets. However, if you read certain critics who are very good at detailing Balanchine's work, I'm thinking in particular of Edwin Denby. His collected writings, I think, give you a lot of insight into Balanchine. The other thing that I would recommend is a book by Suki Schurer called Balanchine Technique. She's very clear about what Balanchine wanted. The other thing that I would recommend, and I love doing this, is that Balanchine wrote a number of articles. Now, it's true that they were edited and put into good English by people like Francis Mason and Lincoln Kirstein. But I do know that a lot of the articles, actually, they say what he wants. They weren't making it, especially when he talks about movement. Okay, now, the other thing is that actually the two Balanchine biographies that are around are really good reads, and they'll give you the basic outline. The thicker, bigger one is Bernard Taper's book called Balanchine's Choreo. I think it's just called Balanchine. And then Bob Gottlieb, who is not only the former editor of The New Yorker, but also hung around City Ballet a lot during the Balanchine years and was a member of the board. He's written a shorter, very readable version that does tell you the basic things about Balanchine's life. What I'm hoping for eventually is people beginning to really talk about the movement. And that's where Suki Schurer's book on Balanchine Technique is terrific. Hope that helps.
One final question.
Short people.
just in consideration of why you're here this week, maybe if you could answer the question, what characteristics does San Francisco Ballet have as a company, or must it have as a company, that make it so qualified to perform Balanchine's work?
Well, definitely it's the heritage. I mean, as I said, ballet is kind of like an oral history. The history of ballet is something that's passed on from master to pupil. And as I say, there are two people. First of all, Lou Christensen and the Christensen brothers. You know, Balanchine mounted Apollo in America on Lou Christensen. And Christensen danced with him, danced in all those early ballets, was with him, had class with him. So what Lou Christensen passed on to his teachers are being passed on in turn to the dancers of San Francisco Ballet. The other thing is that the current director of San Francisco Ballet, Helgi Thomason, is another Balanchine dancer who danced in City Ballet for many years, who took the Balanchine classes, who understands the style, and can give it to his students. It's not secondhand. You're getting a direct through line from Balanchine to Lou Christensen to Helgi Thomason to the San Francisco dancers.
Well, thank you so much, Beth. I'd like to thank Beth Janae for her illuminating remarks today, and to San Francisco Ballet for co-sponsoring the program, our beautiful company dancing the beautiful choreography and fulfilling the legacy of Balanchine. Thanks to our audience today, all of you, and our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Okay.